Hello, rock and roll rebels, and welcome to another episode of Ramble On with Rosie. As I mentioned last week, I was at somewhat of a crossroads as to who to discuss for this week. Do I discuss Rory Gallagher, or do I discuss Joe Strummer and the Pogues? And I decided to discuss all three, or rather a song that was covered by Rory when he was with the show band he was in, by Shane McGowan of the Pogues, and by Joe Strummer when he was with Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros. The song is The Minstrel Boy, which was written after the 1798 rebellion in Ireland, which if you've followed me on my Instagram at all or my Facebook, all March long I've been discussing Irish musicians and music and a lot of Irish folk music, and this is definitely up there with the Irish folk song topic. It was written by a man named Thomas Moore who lived from 1779 to 1852, and fun fact, was probably the first Irishman to ever be photographed. There's a family portrait of him that was done like super early, like 1844 photograph. So that's your fun fact about Thomas Moore, who is definitely not the Thomas Moore who wrote Utopia. That was about 200 years earlier. However, this Thomas Moore also had some unpleasant feelings towards the Tudors, much like the one who wrote Utopia. We'll get into that a bit when we get into the song. The variety of artists who have tackled the song is huge. Of course, the song's been around for a couple hundred years, so it does get covered a lot. Moore was such a wonderful poet, or rather songwriter, the two were sort of one and the same back in the day, that he was complimented by Lord Byron for his talents. Sir Walter Scott praised him as being both better than himself and Lord Byron when it came to putting verse to music. So, very, highly regarded. In fact, it was Moore who was put in charge of Byron's papers when Byron passed, and he gave them to somebody else, and it was that other person who decided that they needed to be destroyed because they were too risque for public consumption, unfortunately. And so Moore had to watch his bestie Byron's, memoir get torn apart in front of him, unfortunately. And, that's up there with, the burning of the library at Alexandria for huge losses to posterity in the realm of literature. However, moving on from tangents, because I am known for tangents, I'll wrap up talking about Moore with one small relevant note that one of his colleagues at college, because he went to Trinity College in Dublin, had collected a bunch of Irish melodies, and it was to those old Irish melodies that Moore had took it into his mind to put English verse to, which was a sort of new thing to do at that time. And so Bunting's, his schoolfellow Edward Bunting's general collection of Irish music was a very big resource, which we will get back to that in just a second when we discuss some of the lyrics to The Minstrel Boy, which there are not a lot of lyrics to this song, but there is a lot to unpack in these lyrics, especially if you love Irish history as much as I do. And then when we get done, we'll conclude with all the artists that I admire who have covered this song. And yeah, so moving on from there to the song itself, we have the opening line, which is, "The minstrel boy to the war is gone, and in the ranks of death you will find him," which is, really depressing. Of course, the song has a very sort of stirring, simple drum beat vibe to it. Really, really well done. At least the version I first encountered it in, which was done by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. So, that being the case, they The song opens with the very sad lines about him, and it's just setting a tone for it, 'cause the song was written, I think, as I mentioned, to commemorate Moore's college friends who died in the 1798 rebellion. So it's coming from a deeply personal place, even if the lyrics just seem sort of generically patriotic. And so the fact that he's a boy and a minstrel and not a man and a soldier just so poignantly suggests, the naivety and perhaps youthful bravado that, this young dying rebel has. Which would obviously, if you've got naivety and youthful bravado, it could easily lead to you joining the ranks of the dead. For some reason, it struck me as a resemblance to how the Tarleton twins in Gone with the Wind behave, especially in the book, where they're giddily optimistic that they're gonna rout, the Northerners out overnight. And, Rhett Butler, of course, is a little more realistic and maybe a little cynical too. And so that sort of vibe, especially because the Tarleton twins and their siblings in the book are all a bunch of flaming redheads, so you kind of guess they've got some Irish heritage, especially with the wonderful rapport their mother has with Gerard O'Hara, who is, Scarlett's father, and who literally named his estate, plantation after the Hills of Tara, which is where the ancient High Kings of Ireland used to, meet and reside and whatnot. So, a little bit of Irish similarities between that fictional character and this, sort of catch-all minstrel boy. Because, I mean, nowhere in the song does it specifically say that he's Irish, but it is an Irish song. But it's been used, at 9/11 memorials and various other places, so it's broadened rather than just being an Irish song. And so I feel like it can be applied to fictional characters too. And then the next line is his father's sword he has girded on, which I read a commentary that was saying his father's sword, suggested that this minstrel boy is ill-equipped for war, which seems a bit repetitive, given the opening lines. And they're like, oh, it suggests that, he's doesn't even have a sword of his own. But really, to me, especially with the following line, it really seems to more suggest the sword being an emblem of the generational, like I said, generational revolts against Great Britain. Because Ireland didn't really stop doing that. That's probably one of my favorite things and why I so deeply admire, Irish history, is that they simply never gave up. They never submitted to British rule for centuries, which is pretty insane when you're a tiny little island, mainly populated by farmers, trying to repeatedly take on totally stacked odds against you, the pretty much greatest military superpower at that time, and you keep trying in spite of, losses. Submitting to foreign rule was never an option for them, which is really, really admirable. I'm like, how did y'all just keep going? That's why I love Irish history so much. They're just that stubborn, which is great. So to me, the sword, his father's sword, is more like the baton being passed from one generation to another of, hey, here are the young whippersnappers now. You go fight the Saxons. If you've listened to any of the Irish folk music I've suggested on my Instagram when I've been posting about Irish folk music all month, the English and British often get referred to as Saxons in song, Ireland's had beef against them for a while, all the way back to them being called Saxons. But yes, so there's that line. So to me, and especially with the following line, because it's also very emblemic too, because the line is with his wild harp slung behind him, which the harp was the national emblem of Ireland for a very long time. It was such a part of the Irish identity that when England really started to put its foot down in Ireland under Queen Elizabeth, one of the first things she did was decree that all harpers be hanged wherever found and that their instruments were destroyed. So, like, it was a hanging offense to play the harp. Hence why, I mean, it was such a emblem of Irish identity to the point that the United Irishmen, who were the group of rebels in the 1798 rebellion, their flag was the Celtic harp on a field of green. Incidentally, green was also outlawed shortly thereafter that rebellion. And you could be hung for wearing it. And or shamrocks as a show of support, or just if you happen to have them growing in your yard. Fun times. Not at all. I'm off on a tangent. We're here to talk about the songs. I can go off about Irish history pretty easily and the cruel, barbaric oppression that they faced. Anyways. But yeah, so the assault on the harp was so vigorous, and fairly successful that by the time Moore was alive, he's about 10, somewhere between 10 and 20 when this event occurred, Belfast had a harping festival inviting all Irish harpers to come and promising that none would be sent away empty-handed. So it wasn't like a, hey, I'm going to spend money to go there and I get nothing out of it. Even if you didn't win, you were still going to get something. But they could only attract 10 Irish harpers and one from Wales. And they were ranging all the way in age from like 15 to 97. In fact, it's interesting, Bunting, who I mentioned earlier as a colleague of Moore's, was the one who was commissioned to transcribe the songs played at the festival. Hence, probably why it got contributed to the collection of ancient Irish music, or rather, a general collection of ancient Irish music that I mentioned previously. So, that being, said, it all comes full circle. But it's really sad that, after, what would that be about? Queen Elizabeth was queen during the 1500s. I'm trying to do math in my head. So after about 250 years of persecution, for playing the harp, you could only scrounge up not even a dozen harp players, and one of them was from Wales. So the assault on emblems of Irish identity was pretty brutal and sometimes quite effective, such as in the case of the Celtic harp and also in the case of the Irish kilt, which was pretty much squelched out before the 1798 rebellion even happened. Fun fact about the Irish kilt is usually a solid color, often kind of a mustard color, rather than the Scottish, kilt with the tartan plaids and various patterns. It's usually one color rather than a pattern. Just your fun kilt history factoids there. But moving on in the song, there is the next line is the land of song, cried the warrior bard, though all the world betray thee, one sword at least thy right shall guard, one faithful harp shall praise thee. The phrase warrior bard to me is really good because it's pretty much a synonym for the usually prescribed ideal for masculinity, which is the warrior poet. So someone like King David from the Bible or Raymond of Poitiers, who was the uncle of Eleanor of Aquitaine and sort of had patronized a little mini renaissance in southern France, around that time of be about the 1100s, so it was before the actual Renaissance by a couple hundred years. But his encouragement of minstrels in France was huge because northern France and where Paris was and stuff were still very down on the, anything vaguely liberal or libertine or artsy and were, pretty stark about things. So the court in Aquitaine, where her uncle hung out a lot with her in Poitiers, was way more flourishing artistically than the national capital in Paris was. Side note there on French history, but minstrels, so it's relevant, right? But anyways, so to me, the warrior bard is very much the same thing as the warrior poet, which is, you know, this ideal for masculinity that, you know, implies they're brave enough to be the warrior, but they're also soulful and have some sort of artistic pursuit or, you know, artistic appreciation at least. Which, I mean, I definitely wouldn't turn down going out with a guy like that. But, side note, moving on to the poor minstrel boy. The next line is, the minstrel fell, but the foeman's chains could not bring that proud soul under. And it's here where you, to me, where you probably come the closest to Moore's personal inspiration. You know, he grew up, or rather went to college, with men like this. You know, you sort of get this more personal vibe in that line, you know, because he's talking about the proud soul. Like, he personally knew this person, which he did. He knew people who died in the 1798 rebellion, as well as in Roger Emmett's failed rebellion that was just, I don't even think, like, 5 years after the 1798 rebellion. It was either, like, 1802 or 1803. So between those two, you know, he lost his college buddies, which would be deeply devastating. I mean, I'm sure the nearest thing to compare it to is if you're of the generation of people who saw your classmates go off to Vietnam and not come home. Only, in this case, these people were voluntarily going to war with an international superpower in the hopes of gaining freedom. So, you know, pretty intense there. Not being drafted for, you know, wars that in other places. They were fighting for their homeland. And, but they, sorry. But, you know, there was the 1798 rebellion. Side note here, as another tangent about Irish history, they're inevitable with me, is that the 1798 rebellion is a huge impact because it keeps getting referenced to, like, a bunch of songwriters during the mid-1800s and the early, you know, 1900s all, like, wrote songs about it, which means it was staying in, you know, people's minds. If people were still writing songs about it, I'm sure other people who weren't artistically inclined were still discussing the 1798 rebellion, which is why it would be worth somebody who's, you know, forte is history more than music, like me, taking a look into, you know, like, writing a paper on the significance, because it could be argued that without the 1798 rebellion, while it failed, the Easter Rising might not have happened. And of course, with the Easter Rising, you get the eventual independent sovereign nation of the Republic of Ireland, where, you know, a good chunk of the island no longer is under British rule, and all that stuff. So, 1798 rebellion, in spite of it being failed, was really significant because it keeps, for the next 100+ years, it keeps getting referred back to in every following rebellion, which the rebellions in Ireland incidentally ended up becoming more frequent after the 1798 rebellion. It sort of lit the flame that it took, you know, a while to finally come to the fruition of Ireland becoming a nation once again, but 1798 rebellion was really important. In just the little bit that I know of Irish history, I'm like, this was a big time event. Now the next line is, the harpy love ne'er spoke again, for he tore its cords asunder, and said no chain shall sully thee, thou soul of love and bravery. Which is a beautiful line, if nothing else. But it also reminds me of this Scottish hero from about 100 years before. He's not really a hero. He's more of a rogue. But his name was Jamie McPherson, which, I mean, that already sounds like he should be some roguish hero, right? And he died about 100 years before this song was written. You know, he died around, like, 1700, I believe. And he wrote a song on the eve of his execution, basically in defiance of anybody getting a hold of his fiddle, because he was a known fiddle player, aside from being a known outlaw and rogue. And so he destroyed his fiddle after playing it in front of the gallows, You know, at least that's how it goes in the song, which he supposedly wrote. At the very least, the song was written about him, and the event did occur. So he plays his fiddle and then smashes it, vowing that nobody else is going to play it, which very much fits in with the line in The Minstrel Boy of, no hand shall sully thee, thou soul of love and bravery. And so that, and I love the story of MacPherson. It's just MacPherson's Lament is a great song. And I'm not saying that Thomas More got the idea from there, but it's likely that he could have, because Thomas More was peers and colleagues with Sir Walter Scott, who has a commentary a little bit on MacPherson's Lament. So the whole theme of destroying an instrument in defiance might have been borrowed from a Scottish rogues story from 100 years before. I'm not saying it's true, but it's possible. Plausible. He would have been familiar with the song, probably. So that's your little side theory for the day, like last week had the side theory about Rory and the Donegal Danny song. But moving on, the next line is, thy songs were made for the pure and free, they shall never sound in slavery, which is pretty hefty coming from, you know, the Irish, who were actual slaves before they became indentured servants. Charles the First or the Second, I have to remember which one, had to make a royal edict banning the breeding of Irish slaves and slaves from Africa to make better stock in the Caribbean. You know, like you would breed Angus and Hereford to get better, you know, by the British government at that time. So much to the point that the king was like, okay, they're not human, but they're not that subhuman, okay? We have to treat them a little bit better than that, which is just appalling and horrid. But also, they... I love the sentiment of the line, literally inferring that the British forces and the loyalists are unworthy of even hearing his instrument. He's like, I'm going to destroy it rather than have anybody else. You can't even listen to it. You're that unworthy. You're that impure. And you're obviously that against freedom. And it's a very prosy line, but it's got a bite to it, because circling back to Elizabeth I, who outlawed harpers in Ireland, as mentioned, she had no problem importing her harpers from Ireland to play in her courts in England and play at the dances. So she basically was appropriating Irish music or something along those lines. And so those harpers, especially if they had any sort of loyalty to their own homeland, their harps did sound in slavery, and, you know, the minstrel boy sort of refuses that fate for himself and his instrument. He'd rather die, and he'd rather have his instrument destroyed than, you know, have it be in bondage. Which is, you know, that's a lot of summation of various, you know, outright slavery and, you know, the trials of indentured servitude that the Irish went through. You know, deportation, all these things. In fact, that was one of the punishments for wearing green, is you could be deported to Australia or wherever there was a convenient penal colony, or hung. Or if you were a woman, the proclamation put it in quotes of something along the lines of you were subject to the abuse of the common soldiery, which, I mean, I don't want to think about what that means, especially in an era where women didn't have a whole lot of rights to begin with, so not a good time. I mean, it's pretty crazy when they're banning wearing of colors / you know, shamrocks. Pretty wild to think about, you know, you could lose your life or be seriously injured or just deported for pretty much any semblance of nationalism. I mean, there was a while, there's songs about it where it's like, they were called the Crappie Boys because they kept their hair short in a time where it wasn't fashionable to do so. And they were loyal to Ireland, you know, the people that were known as the Crappie Boys. And so obviously if you had short hair in that time, you could be, picked up by the law, sort of like in America, even after the Irish immigrated, until they started getting Irish on the police force, you could kind of be picked up for basically just for being Irish. I mean, that's where the phrase paddy wagon comes from, unfortunately. So, Irish oppression is a long and storied history, and this song sort of sums it up in a very beautiful song, while, sort of airing a list of tragedies. But still, it still has an almost optimistic, or at least, sweet tone to it, in spite of it being a series of unfortunate events with a poor young man dying and smashing his harp. So, going back to the artists who have done this, what is it, about 300-year-old, over 300-year-old now, song, it obviously, I first encountered it through the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem version, which I found it very stirring, as I found quite a few of their Irish songs. Their Irish folk music, they do really good jobs. Like, they're a pretty good go-to band. If you see a bunch of different versions of the same song and you don't know which one to pick, and the Clancy Brothers are one, if you go with that one, it's usually going to be pretty decent. There may be some better, but it's not going to be bad. It's going to be well done. So that's a good note if you start delving into some Irish folk music, which this song put me on the path to do. I already had some interest in it from enjoying Celtic Thunder when I was in my teens, and I don't know what prompted me to make this playlist, but I literally have this playlist on Spotify that is just called Songs Against the English, and it started with American Revolutionary songs and some Scottish songs and some Irish songs, and pretty quickly I found this song and put it in my Songs Against the English playlist. And it's not that I hate England that much. Clearly, I love a bunch of English musicians. I'm part English myself. I'm sorry, but the songs that they wrote that are diss tracks on the British are bangers. I don't care if it's the Scottish writing them, or the Irish, or the American revolutionaries. They slap. They're really good songs. I'm like, this is the hottest diss track in history, and it's 300 years old sometimes. So that's why the playlist is labeled as is. It's not that I have some deep latent aggression against Great Britain. But anyways, where it all ties in together is Rory Gallagher did a version of The Minstrel Boy when he was in the show band The Fontanas. The Fontanas had an album of rebel songs that they released in this weird niche of time, like just before the Troubles really got going. And so it was kind of okay to sing a bunch of Irish rebel songs without it being divisive. Shortly thereafter, it started to become divisive. But they did also, they're doing that sort of set the template for the Wolftones, who would do it even throughout the Troubles and, face any flack that came from playing controversial Irish rebel songs in the middle of all the violence in Belfast and other places, in Ireland and whatnot. So there's the Rory Gallagher connection, is he played it when he was in the Fontanas. I tried so hard to find a version of this online to listen to so I could tell y'all about it, but no such luck. I looked. If somebody finds it, please let me know. I would love to listen to it. I was sorely tempted to just buy the CD that somebody had for sale online, but I'm like, that's kind of sketchy because it's not like from Amazon or somewhere notable and reputable. And also, I would have no way to get it in time before, I did this episode, so I wouldn't have been able to share any info about it. But if I ever do, I may make a little special announcement as to what that version was. From what I read online of a review of the Rebel Songs album that the Fontanas did, is that it was well done musically, as it would be with Rory, but poorly produced, very muddy production, not well at all. So that's the Rory Gallagher connection. The Pogues obviously come with Shane McGowan of the Pogues, though he did the song with his group, the Popes. Not to be confused with the Pogues, this is the Popes. I had an attachment to P letter beginning band names, it seems. Or he just liked confusing people. But anyways, so Shane McGowan did it with his other group, the Popes. One of my favorite musicians also did it. And then Little Steven did it with his Interstellar Jazz Band for the soundtrack to the Lilyhammer Netflix original show. That was like the first Netflix original show. And was, oh, what was I going to say, Stevie's in it playing the main character. And I think he produced it and other things. So it's on the Lilyhammer Volume 2 soundtrack. I was not a fan of the vocals. The music was cool and everything, but the vocals left something to be desired. However, as versions of it go, if there was a version that influenced Little Stevens, it would be the greatest version ever. Well, okay, maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but the version by the greatest person ever, to me, of course, Joe Strummer, who did it first off. Granted, his album Global Go-Go, don't say that fast for sure, was released before the Black Hawk Down soundtrack. From what I could scrounge around online and find out, it seems he recorded the version of Minstrel Boy for the Black Hawk Down soundtrack before he recorded the, 18-minute-long jam version of Minstrel Boy that's on Global Go-Go. Which, I really wish I could find something. / I really wish Joe Strummer had lived longer. So that somebody could have asked him how he ended up on the soundtrack for a movie about the American military, because that doesn't quite match up. I mean, it's great, and I love the song. I love it because, unlike the version that he did for Global Agogo, he actually sings it versus the Global Agogo version, which is the version I heard first. I somehow have lived this long and not seen Black Hawk Down when it feels like every other human has. But anyways, that version came up on, I was just playing, Joe Strummer radio on Spotify, and that came up, and I was like, oh, it's my song! Because, Mr. Boy is one of my favorite Irish folk songs. So I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I think it is. I look at my phone, I was like, it is! He's doing it! So I spent the whole 18 minutes waiting for Joe Strummer to start singing properly at some point, because he does a little bit of mumble humming. It's like being on a date and waiting to be kissed, and then you just get left, because I was kept waiting for him to sing the whole song, or at least some of the lyrics, instead of the mumble humming in the background, which is great, and I love the song, but at first listen, I was extremely frustrated. I was like, I have waited 18 minutes to hear Joe sing, and nothing. I'm so disappointed, which inspired me to go to YouTube, and I was like, maybe he sang it when they did it live, which instantly, if you're interested, he did not. It's entirely instrumental when done live. However, I did find the version from the Black Hawk Down soundtrack in which he does sing, and I was like, okay, finally, closure. So frustrated for a minute there. I was like, what? He doesn't sing? But That shocking revelation of Joe not singing for 18 minutes aside, the 18-minute version from Global Go-Go, like I said, that's a really tongue twister of a album name, is really, really good, because I think I saw someone remark that it's kind of like Ravel's Bolero, in that it grows, but it's not that, ever intensifying. It's still, but it's a lot of just sort of improvisation. All the other instruments are sort of doing their own thing at some point, other than the drum beat, which is very similar to the drum, beat in the more traditional arrangements, like the one by the Clancy Brothers. So you've got this solid drum beat that just stays the same and has a sort of martial, kind of reminds you of the scenes in movies like The Patriot or whatever, where there's the one dude with the drums leading the troops, and it's that kind of drum beat. Throughout the whole song, and while, you know, there's Violin by Time and Dog, there's, you know, the rest of the Mescaleros are doing their thing, Joe's strumming and mumble humming, and it's just fantastic. It's well worth listening to. It's very soothing, but maybe that's just me and my attachment to Joe Strummer's work and finding it very soothing, especially, like, the Mescalero stuff. I mean, I'm not over here saying White Riot is soothing. It's not. But, you know, his later stuff with the Mescaleros or even the stuff off of his Earthquake Weather album is very sort of calming, even if it's an upbeat, up-tempo kind of song. But that being said, highly recommend checking out that version. Checking out all the versions, really. You know, form your own opinions on what your thoughts are on the Little Steven and the Interstellar Jazz Band version of the Minstrel Boy. If you know where to find the Fontana's version, please let me know, because I'm always down to unearth some previously unearthed Rory Gallagher. You know, especially with musicians like Rory and Joe, it's always just a gem. It's a beautiful moment when you can find something by them that you've never heard before. You know, because they're not around anymore to make any new music, and it's just like Christmas comes every time you find something that you hadn't heard before. Like me finding Joe Strummer doing Minstrel Boy, which inspired this whole episode. Like, if I hadn't done that, I probably would have been talking about Rory Gallagher's, you know, collaborations with other musical artists, or Joe Strummer and the Pogues' Live in London concert. Instead, I'm here discussing all those artists and more, because I heard Joe Strummer do one of my favorite Irish folk songs, and I happen to really love me some Irish folk music. So that roundabout ramble that took you through 100 tangents into Irish history concluded. I will conclude with reminding y'all to be kind to each other and rock on, and I will see you next week for more fun musical factoids, which I promise will hopefully be a little less circuitous, random, and more on topic with rock and roll, which is where I usually am at. So, catch y'all next week.